1007.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. These are lonely hours for Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair. In his determination to embrace war as a final option for the removal of Saddam Hussein, he is isolated within Europe, increasingly isolated from the opinion of his own citizens, and dangerously isolated from a number of his own members of parliament and cabinet. As if that weren't wearing enough, Blair's previously staunch allies in Washington appeared to waver in their expressions of confidence this week when Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was musing publicly about going to war without the backing of the United Kingdom. It is the British who have been constantly revising the resolution currently before the UN Security Council in hopes of widening support. But news from Downing Street this morning has Blair reportedly ready to give up his efforts to find any agreement at the United Nations. Well, this raises many questions. Will Blair take Britain to war without that resolution he needs so badly? And if he does, will he be ending his own political career? And Connection listeners, if even Britain wobbles in its support of a war in Iraq, how does that complicate the task ahead for George Bush? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests this hour are Graham Allen. He's a Member of Parliament representing Nottingham North in Tony Blair's Labour Party for 15 years. He's joining us from the BBC studios near the Houses of Parliament. Matthew Paris is with us. He's a former Conservative Member of Parliament, and for the last 15 years he's been writing for the Times of London and The Spectator and other publications. Timothy Garton-Ash is Director of the European Studies Centre at St Anthony's College at Oxford University. He's at BBC's Broadcasting House in London. Gentlemen, welcome to all of you. I wonder if I can begin by just going round the horn, perhaps in the order that I've introduced you. Graham Allen, starting with you, let's do the checklist here. The UN is reluctant to embrace any of the variations of British amendments to the resolution. Iraq saying forget the lot. The Washington Post this morning is writing that Tony Blair is so far in the doghouse that he desperately needs some flexibility on the part of George Bush that he's not getting. Public opinion, party opinion, it's all against him. How much trouble is Tony Blair really in?
I think we've got a serious problem for Tony Blair at the moment, and I, for one, wish to extract him from that problem. But, you know, the reason we're in a difficulty is because we're following the George W. Bush timetable to war. Until about 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was a great unity throughout the Labour Party, throughout Parliament, and throughout the nation, that we were prepared to go to war as a last resort against Saddam Hussein, but that we should continue the inspection regime, deepen it if necessary, that we should build up a checklist of things that I'm glad to see has surfaced at the UN this week, that we should continue that containment and that threat policy, which was going very successfully, which had managed to keep together a global coalition against terrorism and transferred it, in effect, to a global coalition against Saddam Hussein. But as soon as it was evident that there was a White House timetable and that we were looking at going to war in the first couple of weeks in March, then the cracks started to appear, because people tended to see this as preemptive, the new foreign policy that came out of the White House last summer, and tended also to see it as disproportionate, a wholly unnecessary response or level of response to the problem that we've got in Iraq when progress was being made relatively peacefully. So that really was the straw that broke the camel's back and made a lot of people in the UK, including loyal members of the Labour Party like myself. You know, we've got very strong party discipline in the UK. I've only ever voted against my party on one occasion in 15 years.
Let me just hear briefly from the Conservative member, or former Conservative member of Parliament, Matthew Paris. How much trouble is the Prime Minister in?
He's in deep, deep trouble. My party, the Conservative Party, the party I used to represent, are more or less supporting him, and he now needs them. And for a British Prime Minister to need the opposition party is desperate. I weary now of railing against the Prime Minister. I've been doing it for the last 6 months, saying that he was going to make a great mistake. There's no point in jumping around now and saying, I told you so. He has made a colossal miscalculation, so colossal that he is actually more of a nuisance to the Americans now than he is a help. George Bush must be saying to himself that it would have been better if the United States had just gone ahead right at the beginning and alone. We've burnt our bridges with most of our European allies, and we're in a desperate position.
Timothy Garton-Ash, how much trouble?
He's in very big trouble. I think that George W. Bush may indeed achieve regime change, but it'll be regime change in Britain before in Iraq. But I do actually disagree with Matthew Paris. I mean, I think, by the way, that Blair's big trouble is not so much his isolation in Europe, because more than half the governments of Europe actually support some sort of transatlantic solidarity. Not even so much with public opinion. I think his problem is above all on the left and with his own party. But I believe that Tony Blair tried to do the right thing in the wrong way. I think he was right to try and get the United States not to go it alone, but to act through the United Nations, to act through its alliances, to act multilaterally. I think he was wrong, and this was his great mistake, not to get at least the Germans on board, some other Europeans on board, before he flew to Washington and offered his unconditional support.
Graham Allen, has Tony Blair made a mistake that a lot of people say that George Bush has made, and that is never really fix on a good reason for a war in Iraq, flipping from, you know, going for multilateral support to protecting Britain from weapons of mass destruction, all the different arguments we've heard?
There are a lot of good reasons for action on Iraq, but what you need to do is have lots of levels of action and response depending upon the level of threat. And the problem, let me first of all say, Tony Blair, I believe, and many people in the UK believe, was actually a good influence on President Bush. I think many of us feel we would have already been at war unnecessarily with Iraq had Tony Blair not intervened with the president when the president target switched from global terrorism to Iraq last summer. But I think what has inevitably happened is, because Blair has been so close to Bush, he's got sucked along with the new foreign policy priorities that what we regard as rather extreme right-wingers around George Bush have moved US foreign policy onto, such as preemptive action, such as a more unilateral view, a view which means that the US isn't involved in the International Court of Justice or isn't really involved in the Kyoto Environmental Accords. And I, for one, was very pleased that our Prime Minister attempted to draw the US administration back into the mainstream of the global family. But in doing so, I think probably, I mean, we will never know this till the history books and the memoirs are written, I think that Tony Blair and George Bush entered some sort of deal where the President said, OK, I'll give you 4 or 5 months through your multilateral UN sort of approach, and if it doesn't work, you'll have to come with me in March. And I think Tony Blair seized upon that bargain, and now the marker is being called in. But the marker is being called in without the Prime Minister having the support of his party, his parliament, or public opinion in the UK.
Matthew, go ahead.
The miscalculation that Tony Blair has made, the mistake that he's made, is to offer contrary and inconsistent hopes to two completely separate groups. Firstly, you have people like Graham Allen in the Labour Party, many outside it, to whom the message from Tony Blair has been, stay with me and I can moderate the United States of America, I can bring the Americans over. To George W. Bush and Washington, Tony Blair's message has been, stay with me and I can moderate the old Europe, I can bring Europe over. The truth is, he's neither delivered Europe to America, nor has he delivered America to Europe, and he now ends up absolutely piggy in the middle and totally exposed.
Now, Matthew, you were writing, you've been writing about the steadfastness of the Prime Minister, that he shows a sort of Thatcher-esque courage under the circumstances, but that the courage he needs to display now is to cut his losses. And
I believe that.
Would he do that? What would he say now?
Everyone has shown courage so far. George W. Bush has shown courage. Tony Blair has shown courage. Jacques Chirac has shown courage in his warped way. You could say that Saddam Hussein has shown courage. Courage isn't the question. Judgment is what's needed. He should make the judgment. Tony Blair must make the judgment that he will not bring either his party or his country or his continent with him in sending British troops into war in Iraq. And although I know many people, including many people who think that he shouldn't have got himself into this position in the first place, are now saying it's too late, war is inevitable, war is not inevitable until the invasion is launched. The troops are there, they are not yet at war, they can be brought home, and we should not despair. He can make that decision, and he would be admired by many for doing it.
Timothy Garton-Ash, is it inevitable?
Well, first of all, just to come back, you know, it's very easy to be wise after the event. The fact is, it certainly wasn't inevitable that Germany would side unambiguously with France against the United States. Germany has never done that before. If Germany had done what Germany's always done in the past, then we would be sitting here saying what a great statesman Tony Blair has been and how he got it just right. So I think we should remember that. I think now it is a choice of evils, and I think that one could argue that the lesser evil might be to try and preserve what you can of the transatlantic relationship, even if that means going to war. But it would be at a huge cost, and I think it might well be at the cost of Tony Blair's own political life.
But hang on a second.
Dick, I think you can also, this is important in respect of the fact that prime ministers in the UK have this monopoly power. They have the powers of the president and of the majority leader, if you like, in the US. They can normally deliver in foreign policy terms, and there's no separation of powers here to keep a check on that, but a powerful leader like Mrs. Thatcher or Tony Blair can normally deliver on foreign policy matters. But I'm afraid on this particular issue, public opinion was never really convinced that it was a good idea to go into Iraq. Many of us felt that the Afghanistan war was necessary and supported it, or the Kosovo conflict was necessary and supported it. But the case was never really made that Saddam Hussein wasn't being forced to comply by the measures that we were already taking. And in failing to make that case, because you are so powerful, you don't need to consult with your parliament, and Mr. Blair neglected his parliament and took it for granted. You don't need to persuade the public. You don't need to persuade your own party. And then all of a sudden turns round when we appear on this inexorable timetable to war in the early weeks of March, turns around and there's no one behind him. And although we may not be very powerful, these other institutions in the UK,
we are
beginning to squeak a little bit with discontent.
Let me get a final word from Matthew Paris, who has to leave us. Matthew, the vote on the second resolution that President Bush is insisting will happen this week, is that Tony Blair's fail-safe point? Is that the point at which he says, you're on your own now?
Yeah, that would be the point. If there were the vote and it were not secured, or if the vote were abandoned because it couldn't be secured, that would be Tony Blair's last chance, last reasonable excuse, as it were, for saying, well, the British troops can go no further. They'll have to either wait or come home. After that, all will be, as it were, lost. But Tony Blair is increasingly this morning talking as though, and the signals increasingly are, that he'll just go ahead with or without a second resolution.
Take Britain to war without the resolution.
Yes, and he can do that under the power of royal prerogative. He can just declare war. There's no need for Parliament to support. But to go into war relying on your opposition, with one or two of your cabinet ministers resigning, as Clare Short will and as Robin Cook, leader of the House, may well, I think would be very, very awkward. I suspect once the war starts, the media will start getting interested in how the war goes, and Mr. Blair's enemies, who are now very numerous, will wait till it's over, but they'll deal with him then.
Matthew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Matthew Paris, former Conservative Member of Parliament. Connection listeners, we continue our conversation about the dilemma facing Tony Blair when we come back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Timothy Garton-Ash, director of the European Studies Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, author most recently of History of the Present, a book we had a chance to talk about earlier on The Connection. Graham Allen is also with us. He's a member of the British Parliament. He is a former Labour Party whip, number four in the party, until he broke with Blair over his support of the UN resolution authorizing war with Iraq. And We're talking about the dilemmas that are faced by Mr. Blair right now. And, Graham, I thought perhaps we could begin this segment of the program less with analysis and more with a little bit of a parliamentary guide here, because I've heard everything from what Matthew just said, that he's got ultimate power, he can go and do whatever he wants now, to people saying, no, no, if Blair takes the country to war under the present circumstances, it could be illegal, that he's spoken to the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, about that. What are Blair's obligations? What can he do in practical terms over the next 2 weeks?
Well, we had a rather unsuccessful democratic revolution in the UK about 400 years ago, and we still live with that, unfortunately. I think you got yours right with the Founding Fathers. But that has left us with one or two difficulties, such as the Prime Minister has inherited all the powers of a past monarch. He has the power to take us to war, rather as Henry V did, although he's under no obligation to lead the troops from the front, as Henry V did. No one can question that. He doesn't even need to report that to the House of Commons and to Parliament. So he has this complete unbridled power in terms of treaty making and going to war that I suspect most presidents would give their eye teeth for. But in terms of Parliament, he really has to sustain his own majority to ensure that he is once again the leader of the main party and the Prime Minister of the day. And it's that where there may be question marks in the long term, because what has happened is that the largest ever number of his own supporters, of any Prime Minister's own supporters, voted against him 2 weeks ago. The resolution that we had before us was that military action, the case for military action against Iraq, was as yet not proven. In other words, while we supported military action, we actually didn't think the time was right and to rush into a premature war was wrong. Now, 201 out of 650 members of Parliament supported that, but of that 201, there were 120 Labour members like myself who said, we don't want to rush into war, thank you.
But that means he still has a majority.
It means a massive majority. However, as I was saying, someone like me, who's only ever voted against my party once in 15 years, this very rigid party discipline we have in the UK, which I was partly responsible for administering in the first Blair term, to get 121 of your own colleagues voting against a Prime Minister of the day is almost unheard of. And that number will go a lot higher, particularly if there isn't a second resolution to give a fig leaf or some cover for the US and the UK to go into Iraq. So the numbers can mount up very quickly, and then you get a change in climate inside Parliament and inside the ruling party that might say perhaps we should be looking elsewhere for a leader. We're a long way away from that, may I say, and it is no part of my agenda or the agenda of most colleagues in the Labour Party to bring about the downfall of our Prime Minister. We respect him, we admire him, we think he's done a super job, and certainly up until about 3 or 4 weeks ago, he commanded a very, very large support of his parliamentary party and indeed a large percentage of the public. But switching on to this timetable for war is what's done it.
Let me turn to Timothy Garton Ash and a step away from parliamentary procedure here, Timothy. Based on what Blair has said, is he morally obliged to respect the UN vote on this second resolution? Is he obliged to take it back to the Commons for one more vote, even if he's not sort of on the basis of procedure obliged to do that?
Well, I think those are two different things. I think that the moral question, it's a very interesting case, this, because, you know, in purely international law, there's much better authority for going into Iraq than there was for going into Kosovo. Kosovo was actually illegal but legitimate. This is legal but probably illegitimate. And then politically, the question is, does he have to take it back to the Commons if he's not going to face a leadership challenge? And I think the answer to that question is now yes. And my hunch is if he tries to go to war without a second UN resolution, the political reality is that when the war is over, he will face a leadership challenge. And that's an extraordinary position to be in. If someone had said that 4 months ago, no one would have believed it.
Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring some of our callers in. First to Columbia, South Carolina. Bob's joining us. Hello, Bob.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, to put some things in perspective here so you'll understand where I'm coming from, I'm a German history major at the graduate level and have been in the military for a long time. and have traveled extensively in the Middle East, especially desert warfare. I look at it from a standpoint of 1938-39 in Europe. People did not want to go to war. People were, you know, all for going over there and getting peace in our time. And as I've had several British acquaintances say, every school child in Britain remembers the Prime Minister coming back waving a piece of paper saying that he'd gotten peace in your time. The Iraqis are very similar to the Germans. I've gone to school with them in college. Very bright people, very surrounded people with a fortress mentality, and that's how you get to a Saddam Hussein or a Hitler.
How do you bring this to Tony Blair for us, though, Paul?
Very simple. He's taken a view of things like I would, oddly enough. I mean, I admire him a great deal for his courage in that he's looked at it and said what Winston Churchill said in the 30s, day after day in the Parliament, that Germany was a threat to Great Britain and the rest of Europe. And he was not listened to until the bombs fell. And if you allow Saddam Hussein to stay in power, sooner or later, he will, because it's his nature. He can't help himself. He's going to get a weapon, and he's going to use it against his neighbors first, and by way of using it against his neighbors, turn off the lights in England and Europe when he controls their oil, because the bulk of the oil in the Middle East goes to Europe, not to the United States.
We get a lot of it. Let me turn to our historian here, Timothy Garton Nash. Mr. Blair taking any refuge in the words of Mr. Churchill here?
He's taking a great deal of solace and I think also encouragement from the example of Churchill. As does almost every occupant of number 10 Downing Street. Churchill is a towering figure. He also, of course, a hero to George W. Bush. But I have to say, historical analogies are tricky things, you know, and everyone always says X or Y is Hitler, and you cannot dismiss quite well-reasoned European criticism of the policy of the Bush administration simply as appeasement. It's much more than that. It's not anti-Semitism, it's not appeasement. There are some good reasons for believing that the case is not proven for war against Saddam Hussein.
1-800-423-8255. Bob, thanks for that to Buxton now in the UK. Peter's listening in online and joining us on the phone. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Dick. Fantastic show, and real credit to you, and I always try and listen from the UK. And I have to say, it's a credit to you, you've got this topic on, and from the British perspective, I can say that I think Graham Allen's right, that people have generally supported Blair, but have increasingly over time felt that we're working to a different agenda here, that Blair's done the right thing, he's done the noble thing, he's followed the hard path, he's trod a lonely path, but in the meantime, the Bush administration, which of course is full of old hardliners who were selling weapons to Saddam not so long ago, is working to an agenda where they've seen the summer coming, the hot weather, they have to get the guy out, and pretty much anything goes. And so all of a sudden now Blair's being hung out to dry. Well,
Peter, let me ask you, if I can, to respond to the editorial that's in the Washington Post today that talks, as you are, about the time that Tony Blair has spent standing at the right shoulder of George Bush. He was there on the 12th of September, 2001, and he's been there ever since. Is it your view that it's high time for George Bush to turn to Tony Blair and say, what can I do to make this work for you?
Well, as was pointed out, we might not know till all the biographies are written and the memoirs are out, and maybe that's what he said. Who knows? I just know that Bush hasn't done himself any favors being so unilateralist in so many other international respects with regard to Kyoto, International Court of Criminal Justice.
But he's not going to be reelected by voters in Buxton, Peter.
He's not, but what we think of Bush affects what we think of Blair's judgment. You know, if Blair was going into this with somebody conciliatory, with a natural mediator like Clinton, the UK would probably back him further and longer, even though there haven't been any killer facts, even though they haven't given evidence to the inspector that's allowed them to go and see where this supposed weapons of mass destruction stockpile is.
All right, you know, Peter, let me ask Graham Allen to join us on this, because the whole idea that the European attitudes towards Bush have been softened or ameliorated by Blair's support. Where are we with that right now?
Well, I'd like to pick this up on the basis of the appeasement question.
Fair enough.
Because as far as I'm concerned, I do believe that war, sadly, has to be a weapon of last resort in foreign policy. And I, for one, would certainly, if the Hans Blix had been given the 2 months he requires when he said he doesn't need weeks or years, he needs months. If Blix had been given the months he requires, if Saddam Hussein had then been given the checklist of clear things that he's meant to be doing rather than just generalised disarm, and if we'd been able to sustain the pressure upon Saddam, and he had then refused to deliver, if he had refused to allow access to inspectors, or if something serious had been found out there, then I would, with most of my colleagues in the UK, been prepared to go to war. A timely war, appropriate to the problem we're facing. But I'm afraid what's happened here is that making a foreign policy judgment is that if you go into war in Iraq now, you are actually going to create more terrorists than you're going to capture. You're going to create those breeding grounds that led, sadly, to the events of September the 11th. And above all, what you're going to do is smash apart the global coalition, which is an absolute precondition for really having a genuine attack upon terrorism in the world. Throwing away the support that we've developed very painstakingly since September the 11th, and pushing away those Arab nations, the Muslim nations, the French, the Germans.
Okay, but bring it to the point that Peter's asking about the degree to which Tony Blair's own respectability as a leader has provided cover for George Bush at this point to say this is a coalition. Timothy, if that is taken away on the basis of Blair's refusal to stick with this after a failed second resolution, how much is lost for George Bush?
My impression from a recent trip to Washington is that that would have a big impact if people in the United States saw that even the British were not going with us. And of course, the opinion polls in the United States show a strong majority for doing this in a multilateral way, so doing it through the United Nations. So I would think that in his own interest, Bush should actually try to wait a few more weeks, give the inspectors a bit more time, try and get a second UN resolution. But, you know, let's talk for a moment about, not about the Churchill, but about de Gaulle, because I blame Chirac and Schroeder in this quite as much as I blame Rumsfeld or Cheney. I mean, I think it is madly irresponsible to go out there canvassing votes in the Security Council against your most important ally, against the United States.
But the United States has been doing the same thing, Timothy.
Sorry?
I said the United States has been canvassing those votes at the same time. I mean, everybody.
Yeah, because we've got into this position where we've got two coalitions. The West is split down the
All
middle
right.
with two coalitions. But please note that the American coalition is with Britain a democracy, Spain a democracy, Australia a democracy. The Franco-German coalition is with Russia, a pretty dubious democracy, and China, which is a dictatorship. So they're not quite the same thing.
I think, Tim, this started actually before the vote-mongering and the word-laundering at the UN in the last week or so. I think the big mistake from Chirac and Schroeder was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, when they were basically looking over the hand of the poker players, if you like, Blair and Bush, who were trying to face down Saddam Hussein and then went off on their own. They were basically calling out the cards rather than helping at that point. And I think at that point, that's when Rumsfeld lost his temper, and that's when the old Europe, New Europe division came in. And I think that was highly irresponsible at that time, and has assisted Saddam Hussein in continuing to do what he's been doing out there.
Let's see if we can squeak in a call here from Southborough, Massachusetts. Robert's joining us on the line. Hi, Robert.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have a very simple point to say. All I'd like to say is I tremendously, tremendously admire Tony Blair, his courage. I find it absolutely inspiring. I think he's a true leader. I wish we had such a leader in the United States, quite frankly.
What has Tony Blair done or shown you that you're not seeing from the White House, Robert?
I guess what I've done is, truthfully, for me, I've come from a transformation of having my personal head in the sand trying to just make a living and ignore what goes on in the world, just pay my taxes. And I had a quite inspirational talk with my young children who were spurred on from, unfortunately, watching Mayor Menino's, we'll say, his advice to us. They happened to catch it, and I happened to be not vigilant enough to turn it off in time. So when they were done, clearly they were very shaken up and asked me, "Daddy, are we going to get killed?" And as a result of that, I wanted to determine for myself whether there was an imminent threat. So I went online, and I've read quite a bit from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Freedom House.
Back to the point, though. What's Blair doing or saying that you're not hearing from your president?
What Blair is basically, from what is Blair specifically saying, I think it is important to try to get the rest of the world to go along. I think President Bush went along with him reluctantly, but I think that Blair's attempt to do so was correct. But more importantly, I think what Blair is doing for me is he's standing up for the principle that this guy, Saddam Hussein, is a very dangerous person, and he's being persecuted for it in his own government and in his own continent for having the courage to state the fact that, truthfully, the pressure should be on Saddam Hussein.
Graham Allen, just a quick comment from you, because we're about a minute away from having to take a break.
You don't stop this Saddam Hussein, and you don't stop dozens of others, and above all, you don't stop thousands and tens of thousands of young men becoming terrorists by mishandling foreign policy and just shooting from the hip. It's a very difficult and complicated situation, and you need to maintain a global coalition. You need Arab, Muslim, and European and North American colleagues working together.
Robert says
breaking that up, as George W. Bush is doing, is the way to create more terrorists.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and it's likely within the next few days Tony Blair is going to have to face the decision of what to do in the face of a second resolution at the United Nations failing, perhaps another vote in the House of Commons, and whether or not he'll continue to stand beside President George Bush. What are the implications for President Bush's intentions to go to war based on that? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is W.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. This is Tony Blair in the House of Commons question time yesterday, just been asked about Donald Rumsfeld's suggestion that the U.S. could go into Iraq without the support of Great Britain.
Of course it is true that the United States could go alone. And of course this country should not take military action unless it is in our interest to do so. It is the British national interest that must be upheld at all times. But the reason why I believe it is important that we hold firm to the course that we have set out is because what is at stake here is not whether the United States goes alone or not. It is whether the international community is prepared to back up the clear instruction that it gave to Saddam Hussein with the necessary actions.
With me on the program this hour, Graham Allen, member of the British Parliament and a member of the Labour Party, supporter of Tony Blair, has broken with Blair over his support for the UN resolution authorizing war with Iraq. And Timothy Garton-Ash is also with us. He's director of the European Studies Centre at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, author most recently of a book called A History of the Present. And Timothy, I'm going to ask you to respond to the Blair comment there, because when he says what is at stake here is not whether the U.S. goes it alone, it sounds in a way that he's saying what's at stake here for me, because you look at it from this side of the Atlantic and it's very important to consider whether the U.S. goes alone or not. So there are...
Of course it's very important, and I don't think those two things are separable, actually, because if the U.S. does go to this war alone, the consequences for the international community are very grave. This means that the whole post-45 international system, the United Nations, NATO, and indeed the European project, are in a sense up in the air. And I am afraid that if we don't get this UN resolution, there are many people in the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld is surely one of them, Dick Cheney probably another, who will say, to hell with the United Nations, to hell with the Europeans, we don't need them anyway, we can do it militarily on our own, and we will, and we're going to fight this war against terrorism, and we're going to win it. Of course, there is not a snowball's chance in hell that the United States can win the war against terrorism on its own by right. military means. Graham Allen is quite right. The United States needs Europe to win the war against terrorism politically, but I think that's what they may try to do.
Graham Allen, when you sit on the front bench and listen to the Prime Minister defending his perspective on here, are you thinking primarily about the Prime Minister and the party and the country and the integrity of that unit? Or are you considering, as Tim just mentioned, the whole post-45 system, the UN and NATO and the future of Europe as well, if they're all part of what's going to happen?
I think the post-45 system has gone, and I think George Bush has actually said very clearly that he really doesn't care less whether this happens through the UN. I don't think, but for Blair and others, that he would be at the UN at the moment. So I think the president's probably written all those institutions off. But I hope it's for, may I say, wiser counsels from people like Prime Minister Tony Blair and others to say that actually isn't the way we're going to beat terrorism. So when I'm sitting listening to the Prime Minister, there are lots of things, lots of institutional things, if you like, going through my head about the post-war settlement, about the future of my party, because Tony Blair has been a great Prime Minister for us and I don't want to lose him. But equally, I'm thinking about whether this is a sensible and correct foreign policy decision. Because if we get this wrong, this is a test, if we get this wrong and end up creating more terrorists than we capture by producing the discontent and by reinforcing this stereotypical anti-Americanism that there is in the Middle East and in the Arab world, we'll have created an absolute monster. And to be frank, when we talk about whether we should respect the United Nations or not, and this is the test, it does ring a little bit hollow for many people who see the United Nations only used when it is convenient for the particular case. People whose support is deeply inconsistent for the United Nations, whether it's on Israel and Palestine or whether it's on North Korea or anywhere else. And to see resolutions being, their name being taken in vain, no one frankly thought that 1441 was an automatic timetable to war. And indeed, those were the US ambassador to the UN used almost those very words. It was a threat. It was an attempt to force Saddam Hussein to do what he should be doing, which we all agree he should be doing. And it should have been taken on then, at that point. And Dr. Blix should have been reinforced in the work that he was doing, rather than have it taken over and given a timetable to war. We talked earlier about the appeasement and the Second World War. Some of this reminds me, sadly, of the First World War, where there was an automatic ratchet effect, where lots of pieces fell into place, and all of a sudden, there are millions of people dying on the Western Front. I only ever wish to go to war because it's conscious, because there's a real reason and a real benefit, and it is proportionate to the problem we face.
Graham, let me interrupt you.
Unfortunately, that is the exact opposite of a timetable.
Number of people who'd like to get in on the lines now to Boston. And John's joining us. Hello, John.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I'm not a politician, so let me speak frankly here. The road to peace leads through... The road to peace, yes, it really leads through Jerusalem, not through Baghdad. And I think that, I know it's a taboo subject in the United States to say this, but if Blair is far too much under the influence of George Bush, I think George Bush is far too much under the influence of the Likud and their friends here in the United States. And
if Israel has an interest in seeing Saddam Hussein removed from power and George Bush wants to acknowledge that, is that a bad thing?
Oh, well, George Bush wouldn't acknowledge that because Saddam Hussein supports the Intifada. Iran wants to support Hezbollah. serious
argument. John, let's not get too far into that. I'm going to take your non-political question and ask our historian to step into the breach here. Timothy, how much does this have to do with the Middle East when we're trying to measure Blair's dilemma? Not Bush's dilemma, but Blair's dilemma.
An awful lot, because whereas during the Cold War, the Soviet threat united Europe and America, now the Middle East is dividing Europe and America. It is the big issue that divides Europe and America. And the irony of Blair's position is that on the issue of how you move forward in the Middle East, he is, as it were, more European. That's to say, he believes, and he's said this, and he's tried to push this agenda, that the key to progress in the Middle East lies in getting a settlement between Israel and Palestine, which results in the creation of a viable Palestinian state. And I wish that Washington were listening to that, because actually this is the big issue on which Europe and America should be working together.
And the issue upon which they're disagreeing very quietly.
Most strongly.
Yeah, all right. 1-800-423-8255 to Boston again, and Michael is on the line. Hello, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that the British people are basically blinded by the hatred of Bush to the real issue, which is Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. I don't agree.
How do you
with,
see that playing out, Michael?
I just see that people just hate Bush so much that, you know, they're not making Saddam the issue, they're making Bush the issue, you know, when Saddam should be the issue and we should be putting all our attention on him and disarming him. You know, I don't agree with 90% of Bush's agenda, but I do agree with this one thing.
Graham Allen?
I think George W. Bush and the Prime Minister of the UK are absolutely right in seeking every possible way of removing Saddam Hussein and removing the weapons that it's alleged that he still has. And we should know because we sold him most of them.
But speak to Michael about this anti-Bushism, because we hear it in voices from the street all the time. People saying we're not against America, we're just against George Bush. But it, you know, how much does that tip the scales for Blair under the current circumstances?
I don't think, well, I can only speak for myself and the people I know. I don't think there's any hate for George W. Bush. I think there's a feeling that he's got a major error going now on foreign policy, and that error could be catastrophic. It can certainly be catastrophic for our Prime Minister, whose career may be on the line here, and therefore my party, but it could far more importantly be catastrophic for the global attack upon terrorism, which we all need to be united about rather than split up into warring factions at the United Nations or elsewhere. So I think George W. Bush needs to reassess the best way to do what we all want to do, which is to reduce the power of Saddam Hussein, get him out of there if possible. And we had a viable strategy, a strategy that was working based around 1441, which was firstly to contain Saddam Hussein, secondly to pull his teeth to get those weapons out there by getting the inspectors in there. They have found nothing significant or serious in the time they've been there. So let's get into more depth. Let's have more inspectors. Let's get more precise about our questions that we want answered. And the whole world was behind that strategy.
All right, Timothy,
but in order to rush to war, we're burning people off as if we didn't want allies. And that's the thing that frightens people about George W. Bush. It's fear rather than hate or dislike of the man as an individual.
Timothy Garton-Ash, I wonder if you can speculate a bit for us here. If, for example, the resolution at the United Nations, the second resolution, is not passed, and if Tony Blair looks at his options and decides that perhaps he can no longer support his colleague, Mr. Bush, what kind of stand could he take based on the credibility that he's built? What kind of stand could he take now as the outspoken opponent of Saddam Hussein and the outspoken supporter of stepped-up inspections?
I think that would be very difficult for him to sustain, I have to say. I think it's unlikely that he will suddenly turn round and say what the French and the Germans have been saying, as it were, join the Franco-German coalition and say we can do it by containment and by inspections, because he would be arguing against himself. I think he would not be credible. So I think the realistic question is what happens when he decides in the end, gritting his teeth and crossing his fingers, to go with George W. Bush, even without a second UN resolution. And my hunch then is that the country to some extent unites our boys while in action, because that's what Britain does, but that after the war is over, then he probably faces a leadership challenge. And I think the irony of this situation is that the people who in my book are behaving really irresponsibly and shooting from the hip are Jacques Chirac on the one side and Donald Rumsfeld, and they'll be sitting secure in their seats, and the man who in my view has tried to steer the right and wise and reasonable middle course in the larger interests of the West, Tony Blair, will be for the high jump.
I think Donald Rumsfeld actually offered a way out for Tony Blair recently when he said that we actually don't need the UK to go in with us, but that window of opportunity was there for about 12 hours, and Tony Blair decided to slam it firmly shut, and he's determined to carry on. I think it's not a matter of whether Blair reunites with the rest of Europe and the other nations in the world. I think it's a matter of whether George W. Bush and his policy unites and reunites America so that we're a lot stronger as a global family in tackling problems like Saddam Hussein and global terrorism.
Well, Graham, let me ask you to help us with a different sort of speculation, and that is that if the events unfold as Timothy suggested they might, that George Bush and Tony Blair choose to go to war even without a resolution or any of the votes that we've been discussing, and the war goes as wars would or might go very well in terms of it being short and relatively bloodless, can they come out of this with their honour actually enhanced, either within Great Britain or in a larger sense?
Well, I don't know about their honour. I mean, I don't think the honour of two politicians is worth the life of a single soldier, frankly, but I know what you're saying. I think the war's going to be easy. It's going to be the peace that's going to be quite difficult. Iraq will split into several pieces.
Right.
You'll get a massive instability in the region. If there is any weaponry over there of substance, and we haven't found any yet, but if there is, it's the sort of stuff that can be carried off by individual generals, majors, and even individual soldiers to friends and relations who may be terrorists.
In
who
the way that
the
Afghan warlords split up the spoils after their war with the Soviet
Union.
Yeah.
Possibly more so, because you will have been bombing those individuals and perhaps killing their members of their family, and that's what I mean by creating the breeding ground for terrorism. So the war going into Baghdad on the back of a tank waving the stars and stripes and the Union Jack may look great in the short term, and I for one hope it is a very quick war, but if it takes place, but I'm afraid the peace, we're going to be picking up the pieces from this knee-jerk response and timetable war for many, many years to come.
Graham, thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
It's been my pleasure.
Graham Allen is a Labour Party Member of Parliament. Timothy Garton-Nash, nice to have you back.
My great pleasure.
Timothy is Director of the European Studies Centre at St. Anthony's College at Oxford College. Earlier in the program, we talked with Matthew Harris, who's a political columnist for the Times of London. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour of The Connection,